Support comes from Fox Tucson Theater's Picture Palace series, a diverse mix of classic films, family movie events, music and movie nights featuring local musicians paired with a themed movie, and independent Mexican film screenings by Cinema Tucson. More information is at foxtucson.com.
Let's all go to the lobby. Once invited movie audiences to take a break and refuel at the concession stand. Now, Arizona Spotlight producer and host Mark McLemore and film essayist Krista Scheel invite film fans to join them in the lobby. Stock up on recommendations and share some history and conversations about great films from across time and around the world. In this show, we welcome two guests. Tucson resident Alice DeBuer, a lifelong musician, was the drummer for the trailblazing all-woman rock band called Fanny in the early 1970s. Their story is told in the 2021 documentary film Fanny, The Right to Rock. And Barbara Selznick is an assistant professor in the University of Arizona School of Theater, Film, and Television. Her writing about film includes Sure Cedars, The Emergence of Art House Cinema, and articles for Film History, Velvet Light Trap, and the Quarterly Review of Film and Video. The first topic of discussion is films that made strong first impressions, either positive or negative. Barbara Selznick begins.
I remember watching Carrie when I was really young. Mm-hmm. I remember sitting on my parents' bed watching this by myself. And the TV was probably, 13 inches. Like it's the smallest screen ever. But to this day, I hate horror films. I mean, I cannot watch that kind of blood and gore. It scares me, and I don't even go near it.
Alice, what about for you? What was a film that you think you were exposed to a little too young in life?
I think it's only in hindsight that I can answer that. And in the small town where I grew up, they had a small group of people who liked foreign films. And Jules and Jim and Sundays and Sibel were two of the films that struck me and really hit a chord. Sundays in Sibel, it made me angry that the people took the guy away from the little girl because there wasn't anything going on. And it was like the injustice of it that upset me, and I didn't know what to do with that.
Chris, you're nodding as if you have seen the film. I haven't seen that one.
Jules and Jim, of course. I mean, Jean two, Moreau. And,
yeah, it's amazing. Amazing.
Okay. And two men. Uh-huh. And that was considered really something then.
Is it a triangle?
Yeah. Oh, well, it's actually they both love her and they were best friends too. So that was what was different. Instead of it being a traditional triangle where the two men or the two women hate each other, it was like they're all very close. Oh, those French.
A dramaturgical triad.
Oh, those French.
Well, you can say that again. Okay, you mentioned your origins in Iowa, Alice, and you, when we first talked, you told me about a connection that you have to one of the most famous musicals, and I think that's really fascinating.
Well, I was born and raised in Mason City, Iowa, which is the home of Meredith Willson. So the Music Man premiere was, of course, Band Festival Day was an annual event with all the little towns in northern Iowa and southern Minnesota would come down and they'd march down Federal Avenue and what have you. But that year, Meredith Willson came, and Robert Preston was there. Shirley Jones was there. Pick a little, talk a little, pick a little, talk a little, pick, pick, pick. Or the Ode to the Grecian Urns. Anyway.
I just remember Ronnie Howard was in it, and Buddy Hackett.
Yeah, yeah. And that became, Mama used to take us to the theater, and she'd drop us off if it was an appropriate film. So it was South Pacific, it was Oklahoma, it was Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, it was The Music Man. That's where my love of musicals came from. Now, I don't just like musicals, but if someone says, what kind of films do you like? That's one that I do like, one genre, if you will. Mm-hmm. Yeah, The Music Man, the Meredith Willson footbridge is there in Mason City, and Mason City's very proud.
Meredith Willson.
He was
they didn't film the movie in there, did they?
No, they did not.
Right.
Not at all.
Probably on a soundstage in Hollywood.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I saw that when I was a kid, and I have to admit I liked it.
Yes, good.
Is it 76 trombones?
Right.
That's the standout tune for me.
The whole
me.
Thing about the con man and the...
You got trouble.
You got trouble, trouble, trouble.
Right here in River City.
Right.
Right here.
It's on Broadway right now, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
With Hugh Jackman.
Yeah.
I saw they did the 76 on the Tony Awards. They did the 76 trombone song, Tap Dancing Away. And I said, no, that's not it. That's not how it goes. So Meredith Willson is the Grand Marshal. And he's in the Cadillac. And as he's coming down the street, the bands from the sides of the streets fill in to make 76 trombones and 110 cornets. And he got out of that car and just pranced up and down the street. I mean, it was cool. I was junior high school.
Barbara, as far as any memories that were triggered by Alice's account of the parade or musicals or...
The biggest memory that came back to me was when I was in graduate school, I had a good friend who's still a good friend who was writing her dissertation on the representation of Asian characters by non-Asians. Her book is wonderful, Hollywood Goes Oriental. It's a great, great book. And for that, shockingly, she had to watch a lot of musicals. And so she always wanted me to come over and watch these musicals. And I cannot stand musicals. I'm sorry. To me, they're long and I'm move the plot along. Why are we stopping and singing? I mean, some musicals I love. Singin' in the Rain, I love Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers musicals, but the big Rodgers and Hammerstein. So she used to bribe me with pizza to make me, so that I'd watch these musicals with her. And, you know, it was all worth it because her book's amazing. And the pizza was good because we were in Chicago. So, but I've just never been a musical person. Though I'm sitting here, this morning I was just like, well, I should probably show The Greatest Showman in my class this coming semester, because it's a class about narrative and history and what they do with that character, the way that they sort of erase a big swath of the history behind him. But it's like, well, do I want to sit through a musical?
That one was really divisive.
Which is why I'd show it.
It pleased audiences, but
it
didn't please many critics.
Yeah. And you know, I get it. Like, the music's fun and Hugh Jackman is incredibly charming in everything he does. But it's historical enactment of this.
Yeah, it's not historical.
Right. I mean, it's right. Yeah. It's the lack of history. And I don't believe that films need to be historically accurate unless they're claiming to be historically accurate. And then I have a problem with it.
How did you feel about it, Chris?
I didn't see that film.
Yeah.
But
I avoided it myself.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is it about P.T. Barnum or something?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And he's a great guy.
According to the film.
Right there.
Yeah,
exactly.
He's a great guy.
Stop me right there.
No one who worked in his circus ever felt exploited. Not a single person.
Well, and the whole movie is about how empowered these people were by him.
Right.
And it's
revisionist history.
Yeah.
Quite, which is why I saw it. And I also saw it at the theater, which I don't know if it's still there, but the cheap seats over on the east side.
Okay.
So I was like, I'm willing to spend $2 on this.
I was thinking about musicals today. One thing that strikes me about all of them, or most of them, is that there's just this vulnerability, like this willingness to just belt out your emotions in song mm-hmm. that you don't find in realistic drama or any kind of other movie, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, because especially in America, I think we're taught to be very contained and not be so out there, you know, whereas the musical is just really goes against that. And sometimes it's embarrassing, but sometimes it's quite sweet. So it just depends on how it's done. Well, I like a lot of musicals, and there's some that I can't stand, and that's just kind of how it is.
Well, you found the bright side to how I look at musicals, which is that there's no subtlety required for most of the characters. They sing their emotions.
Right.
And I want to watch an actor and find the performance, find the character. And so I'm looking at all the subtle ways the performer is indicating what they're feeling instead of waiting for them to go, I got a mighty big boat. Will that boat float? Yes, sir, that boat will float.
What's that from?
It's from my imaginary hell musical where it's all about a guy who builds a big boat.
Didn't you had to ask.
I can see it now. Noah the Musical.
Yeah. I can't believe that hasn't been made.
I know.
It's coming to Broadway any minute now.
Yep. Let me call my agent.
They can do anything.
But that's what I think of. But actually hearing the way you described it, that was nice. Like, mm-hmm. the idea that, you know, in a musical environment, a character can just open up. And because I'm a hard on my sleeve kind of guy, so I should.
Well, if you think about some of the songs, let's talk about the Music Man. If you think about when the librarian is singing her heart out, nobody's there, and you get to see maybe the facial acting, if you will. It almost sounds to me, when you were talking about wanting to watch how the character, you know, develops the part, mm-hmm. that it's like dissecting the movie. And I don't like to dissect. If an actor does a good job, you can have an actor just run the gamut of emotions with their face. And I love that when an actor does that well. Mm-hmm. And in a musical, I don't think it's so black and white. I think that you do have, sometimes you get that emotion, and then maybe they might break into song, or maybe they've just finished the song and then the emotion hits and they have that opportunity to do the acting.
For real fans of musicals, how an actor sings, how they perform and deliver a song is what they're like waiting for. Like, that's the Broadway dream. And that's what, you know, how like Barbra Streisand established herself. Right. And speaking of Barbra Streisand, I bought a box of movies once at the library book sale here in Tucson. You know, we have these cool library sales, and they had it. It was 50 classic movies. So I thought, oh, that sounds like fun. You know, I'll just buy this box and I'll watch all the movies. And I did, except for the Westerns. I skipped a bunch of Westerns. But that meant that I watched Hello, Dolly for the first time. I also watched a movie that I absolutely loathed, and I didn't know I loathed it until I watched it. It's called On a Clear Day You Can See Forever. It was a Barbra Streisand vehicle, and her ne'er-do-well brother in the play was Jack Nicholson. And I thought, what universe has Barbra Streisand and Jack Nicholson as brother and sister? But I will never forgive that movie, because his character's name is never going to leave my mind now. And his character's name was Tad Pringle.
Just a tad.
And seeing Jack Nicholson dance around and sing as Tad Pringle, I would like to forget that ever happened.
But I'm just thinking, that's a great dog name. Like, like, if someone had a dog named Tad Pringle, I'd be very impressed.
There came a time when non-singers were put in the film versions of musicals because they thought, oh, you have to have a star. And I'm thinking of Audrey Hepburn and My Fair Lady instead of Julie Andrews, and then Natalie Wood in West Side Story, who she had to have her voice dubbed. And there's other examples, people who shouldn't be singing, who are singing, actually singing, like in Camelot, Vanessa Redgrave actually sang, and it was not good. When you have perfectly good singers that you could put in these films, you know, that's where you want to go to a musical, to hear the singing, in my opinion. So I thought that was misguided, even though, you know, West Side Story and My Fair Lady are actually pretty good movies, to put it mildly.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's just an extreme version of what you see in a lot of movies where they stick a star in it, when you know that there was probably a better actor who could have done that role. But, you know,
true.
That's
Hollywood.
Let's get someone named Chris who's been in a Marvel movie, and they'll be in this movie. And then
they have more Chrises than they know what to do with.
Exactly. Yeah. They need to keep them busy.
Yeah.
And they're all on Netflix in these great action movies that make no sense.
Someone pointed out that Chris Pratt's name, if you just put a little nuance on it, comes out as Crisp Rat. And I can't not hear that now. And so, once again, you know, my brain is my greatest enemy, because I hear this movie starring Crisp Rat. Anyway.
You're not a well man.
I'm not a well man. These mood swings are a real problem. Yeah, another example of an actor being put in a musical is Christopher Plummer in The Sound of Music. He was dubbed.
There you go.
As I've already discussed on this podcast, The Exorcist is my Sound of Music.
The Exorcist did not frighten me one bit. I went to that, and the whole audience was, ew, ew. And we saw it at a screening on the Warner Brothers lot.
Wow.
And it was like, okay.
You were pretty cool about the whole thing.
The movies that frighten me are the thrillers that, or the action films that could really happen. You know, this could really happen, and was it Audrey Hepburn in that film?
Wait Until Dark.
Wait Until Dark.
That's such a good movie.
Oh my gosh. Scary as hell. That's a horror movie.
Yeah. Well, you know, I haven't seen The Exorcist, and I will never see The Exorcist.
really wasn't
it's
that
It's not
bad.
On the bucket list. But you know, I went to see A Fault in Our Stars, and I don't know if you know this teen. It's based on a, you know, tween.
I've heard
That's
of
like
it.
My daughter, who was, you know, teen, tween, whatever, at the time. It's about a kid who, I don't want to give this away. But anyway, it involves children and cancer. Okay,
yeah.
And we finished, and my daughter had been sitting with friends, and I was sitting, you know, several rows behind where the moms belong.
The dutiful mother.
And,
yes.
And we left the theater, and she's like, what'd you think? And I was like, that was a horror film. Any movie that involves a kid with terminal illness, that is a horror film for me. I think horror is interesting because everybody finds something different, truly scary. While I don't see movies like The Exorcist, for a long time, nothing with children in danger. Could not watch anything with children in danger.
You think that was the mother instinct?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I think, you know, especially for when I had younger kids. Now it's a little bit better. But I remember seeing Crash, not the really horrifying one, the really problematic one. Yeah. I mean, I guess both like really horrifying in different ways. And there was one scene where a man was holding a gun on a child.
Right.
And I had to get up and walk out of the theater. And I never walk out of the theater.
Mm.
Know, for anything.
Here's a tip, Barbara. Never watch Assault on Precinct 13.
I remember The Dark Knight. They actually had, I think the Joker was threatening a child in that one, which I thought was just, no, you don't have to do this.
There are so many Batman movies at this point. Looming around my head. I can't keep them straight.
I can help you out with that.
Yeah. I just think it's really interesting the way that horror can mean different things to different people.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's something that we talk about at the beginning of every semester. You know, it's in my syllabus, and I tell my students, we're going to see a range of things. I don't know what's going to upset you, but you know your personal past, and you know what's going to upset you. Like, it can't be something that you just don't agree with, and it can't be something that you just find annoying or boring. But if, you know, if there's something that, you know, is really a problem for you, because you don't know what people have gone through, you don't know what their past is, then I said, just get up and walk out of the room. And send me an email, and I'll find something else for you to watch. But I do have to clarify that it's not because, you know, you just don't agree with what you're seeing on the screen.
Right.
It
or
has to be.
Bored.
Or you're bored. Or, you know, you want to do something else. Because I do give them other assignments. It happens very, very rarely, but I do give them something else to watch.
That's actually pretty generous of you. You know, very compassionate ahead of time before it gets to that point. I don't know what made you start doing it, but... That shows a lot of compassion for people that you don't know.
I think most people in our program do that. I'm not sure. I would guess that most people in film programs do that at this point. I'm not sure if it's required. I've been doing it for a while. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that, you know, because of things that, you know, going on in my life, I couldn't watch certain movies. I couldn't watch Dead Poets Society for a while.
Oh, you know? I found that film very triggering.
Right.
I did.
You know?
Yeah.
And I was like, okay. You know, if I feel it, and this is my job, this is a class for them.
You know, you put your finger on something there, though, that for me, even though it's not inspired by my life experience, and I'm very thankful for that, I did not grow up in an abusive home, but I have real trouble watching abuse on screen. And it's not necessarily even the physicality of it. It's when someone crushes someone else's dream.
Spirit.
You see their spirit being broken. And so seeing people sacrifice their well-being for others in a heroic sense is one of the most emotional things that I can see in a film and always gets me choked up. That's why I like Marvel movies.
But I was going to say, you like Marvel movies, and all these superheroes do is sacrifice their own personal interests for everybody else.
Yeah, yeah. And that's
got to save the universe this week.
Again.
I mean, poor Spider-Man.
I think with depictions of abuse for me, it depends on whether the film really has a serious intent and whether it's emotionally honest, like it's really making a point, or if it's just being used as a plot device, in which case I find it gratuitous. So it really depends on how it's used. Mm-hmm. It needs to be meaningful if you're going to show that kind of thing.
Yeah.
There's a website that you might have heard of called Does the Dog Live? I think that's the correct title, but it is a place where you can look up a film. Say your family wants to go out to the multiplex and you know there's a dog in this movie, so you look it up and then it'll say yes or no.
That's really funny.
Old Yeller, no.
I showed my kids Turner and Hooch, you know.
Yeah.
Does
the dog live?
In Turner and Hooch? Can I say?
Well, we have spoilers.
Yeah. I already have the feeling that it's going to be a bad answer.
Yeah, it's a bad answer. And Tom Hanks talked about how, you know, what he learned from that movie was that you don't kill the dog in the end. It's a comedy.
It's like this
action comedy, and the dog dies.
They spun it off into a TV show just like a year ago.
Mm-hmm. Did they really?
Yeah, they did.
Yeah, and it's a prequel.
So it's a puppy.
Well, yeah, but who? Well, okay, so whatever. Yeah. I mean, they end the movie with, like, you know, he got more dogs. But, you know, I remember watching Independence Day in a movie theater.
Uh-huh. I was going to say, Independence Day, the dog lives.
The dog lives. And, you know, people are dying all around. I mean, it's like, you know, full on massacre. But when that dog ran through some tunnel, mm-hmm. you know, you see it's alive, the entire audience bursts into applause.
The dog always has to live.
Yeah. That's and it. I do love dog movies. A strange amount, how much I love dog movies.
At the time that we're taping this conversation, one of the big films that's pulling in box office right now is the return of Tom Cruise as the character Maverick from Top Gun. Now, I remember when I was a teenager, I was on a double date, and we talked about what movie to go to, and I was voted down 3-1, and so I had to see Top Gun. Otherwise, I would have gone through my entire life not having seen the film. And by the way, in my world, three against one is a tie at best. But I just wonder if that evokes any memories in any of you about being maybe outvoted to go see a movie or having to see a movie from peer pressure that maybe you otherwise would have chosen not to see.
Top Gun.
You know,
you
once
should have given us these questions before we got
people
here.
People took me to Porky's once, and I was just absolutely appalled. But yes. I wanted to hang out with these people, and so I went with them. Mm-hmm. Terrible, terrible film.
And another film that could be triggering to a lot of people.
I think that most of the movies that I see, it's a unanimous vote to go see. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows that I don't like action adventure. I like happy endings, please. But I will take a sad ending, you know, if I have to.
But I'm just going to remove all the children's movies that I saw that involved little animated things.
Yeah.
Forget those. I mean, the movie that came to mind, and this is inconsequential in a lot of ways, but I remember going to see this George Hamilton movie when I was a kid called Love at First Bite.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
My family wanted to see it, and I desperately didn't want to see it because it sounded scary to me. You know, he plays this vampire, and I thought it was going to be scary. And I remember crying because I didn't want to see this movie. But it was playing at the movie theater near my house that the way that this movie theater worked, it charged whatever year it was. That was the cost of the theater. So if it was 1983, it was 83 cents to get in. And 82, it's 82 cents to get in. It didn't last very long, but, you know, it was, you know, so it was inexpensive. That's the movie theater we went to.
The Cinemark 7, home of the creeping price hike.
Right. But, you know, going up a penny, I mean, now that sounds ridiculous, right? You know, mm-hmm. like that little for a movie.
Well, what happened in the year 2000?
It did not last to the year 2000. Oh, my goodness.
But no. What did you think of the movie, Love at First Bite?
I remember thinking it was funny. And afterwards, you know, my mom saying it wasn't so bad after all. I mean, it wasn't a good movie, but it wasn't, you know, it was certainly wasn't scary.
Very campy.
Yeah, it was campy.
I saw it when I was a kid because it had a vampire in it.
I saw it despite it having a vampire in it.
I was disappointed to find out that George Hamilton was only an actor, but I still remember that. And there's a scene in that film that I still remember vividly where he meets a woman who's kind of portrayed as being sort of like an Annie Hall, kind of a ditzy character. And they're at her apartment and she opens her refrigerator and she pulls a cat out of the refrigerator and she goes, "That's where you've been."
Bringing us back to cat.
So, yes, but there's some very poorly dated humor in that, both involving the sexual revolution and in the 70s and also racial humor in that film that has earned it its place on the dustbin of history.
Yeah. It's not one of those movies that I've looked at and said, oh, I should make sure my kids see that.
Right.
The way that some movies that even though they are dated, you still feel like, eh, they should see that.
It also probably cemented that George Hamilton really was not an actor.
But he had a great tan.
Great tan.
He was known for his tan, yes.
No acting ability, great tan.
Great tan.
Has there been a time, Barbara, when you showed your children a film that you really love and they hurt your feelings by being indifferent or even not liking it at all?
The Marx Brothers.
Oh, yeah. That would be a tough sell.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because when you almost have to find that on your own.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There was one summer, I can't remember which, I did a lot of classic movies. You know what? It was probably, you know, spring and summer of 2020, mm-hmm. when they were captive. Mm-hmm. You know, we did things like Bringing Up Baby, and they loved that. That was fun. And Hitchcock went over really well with my son. But the Marx Brothers really surprised me. Because I love Mel Brooks. Love Mel Brooks. I mean, I think my daughter's favorite movie is Spaceballs. If your favorite movie is Spaceballs, how do you not at least appreciate Duck Soup? And I think soon after that, I was no longer allowed to pick the weekly movie. I think I lost my credibility there.
Well, Duck Soup is maybe 40 years older than Spaceballs, at mm-hmm. least.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But it's great.
Oh, I love the Marx Brothers, but you know, it's like Mark said, I discovered it as an adolescent, and I wasn't told. My parents didn't tell me to watch it, so it was sort of like it's subversive for us as teens, but who knows?
Or you need to see it as an adult, you know, find it as an adult,
right?
You know, where you can understand and you can grasp the
A lot of the Groucho humor is over, I think it's over a kid's head. Well, the fact that they liked Bringing Up Baby shows, I think, a certain amount of open-mindedness.
Yeah.
There's a black and white film mm-hmm. from 1938, and they liked it, so.
Yeah.
It's a great film.
Yes.
It's when genuinely
they still
funny.
And it's when they still made really, really good movies.
Yeah.
You can have your Marvel movies, and I'll up you to Bringing Up Babies. I'll raise you.
Now, I watch classic movies, but I will tell you about Bringing Up Baby. That is one of my good friend Pam's favorite films. She's a true film lover.
Mm-hmm.
And I once lost a trivia game. What was baby was the question. And mm-hmm. I said a chimpanzee.
Oh.
No, the leopard.
Yeah.
I don't think there was a chimp in Bringing Up Baby, actually.
Well, not with a leopard on the set.
Yeah. Lunch.
There was, but they had to cut it, unfortunately.
That seems far too traumatic.
Went to the horror spectrum.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat. Delicious things to eat. The popcorn can't be beat. Sparkling drinks are just dandy. The chocolate bars and the candy. Let's all go to the ourselves a treat. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Let's All Go to the Lobby is a production of AZPM. The recording engineer was Leah Britton. The music in this episode was by Gabrielle Pietrangelo. Thanks to the University of Arizona School of Theater, Film, and Television.
Support comes from Fox Tucson Theater's Picture Palace series, a diverse mix of classic films, family movie events, music and movie nights featuring local musicians paired with a themed movie, and independent Mexican film screenings by Cinema Tucson. More information is at foxtucson.com.